gather around. I'm glad everybody came out tonight. As we stand on our neighborhood corner, know that this fire that's burning represents the passion you have. Listen. I recognize all of you. Every creed and color. With that being said,
we had! We had!
Say what?
Now beat that.
Oh, yeah!
Now what we want you all to do is sit back, y'all. And just relax, y'all. Sit back, y'all. And just relax, y'all. Sit back, y'all. And just relax, y'all. And if you dig it, let me hear your finger snap, y'all.
Now, before I finish, let me just say, I did not come here to show out. Did not come here to impress you. Because to tell you the truth, when I leave here, I'm gone. And I don't care what you think about me. But just remember, when it hits the fan, brother, whether it's next year, 10 years, 20 years from now, you'll never be able to say that these brothers lied to you, Jack.
Okay, I'll reload it.
From the sports bars to the stands, we are the voice of the fans. You are now plugged into your sports mixtape. This is the Section 357 show, where we always have the best seats in the house, and we are presenting to you the Ball Street Journal. We are your Ball Street Journal reporters, D, Trey, Ron, and myself, Floyd. Fellas, how you doing?
Doing absolutely fantastic, as always. Fans of the show, I cannot express how excited we are to have this show, to bring to you this show that we're about to bring to you. It's going to be epic. It's going to be fantastic. Let me toss it over to my man, Ronnie. How you doing?
This is a truly special edition of the Section 357 show. Mr. John Wooden, head of the Fritz Powell Alliance, joining us today to talk about the Rooney Rule and the advancement of minorities in coaching and front office positions. Truly an honor. It's truly an honor to have him on. I'll just kick it right over to Floyd to bring our guests into the proceedings.
Ron and Dee, as you mentioned before, the word special might be a bit of an understatement as it relates to this particular show. The chairman of the Fritz Pollard Alliance, Mr. John Wooden, spent some time with us to talk about the Rooney Rule, how the rule got started, and really gave us some great perspective on the league as it relates to minorities and the growth and development of minorities in the NFL. So without any further ado, we're going to present to you that conversation. First off, Mr. Wooden, thank you again for spending some time with us today. And just to start off our conversation here and talking about the Fritz Pollard Alliance and everything that you all have been able to accomplish through the Rooney Rule, talk a little bit about the early days of when you all were first bringing this coalition together and what your mission was.
I've been in the National Football League as a player since 1959, playing there with the Cleveland Browns, and then, of course, leaving there to go work with the Dallas Cowboys in the personnel scouting area. And then following that, I went to the league office in 91 and created what we call today the player engagement program that Troy Vinson does such a great job of directing that program today. And then I got the old feeling, even though I had a great job there in the league office, I got the wanting to be back in football. So I left there and went to the Philadelphia Eagles, and there as a scouting and personnel guy, and then was there with the Eagles from 92 until 98, And from there, I went to the Baltimore Ravens, which were once the Cleveland Browns, where I had played. So that's how I got back over to Baltimore, and then would come home. What had always been was that we, and when I say we, now I'm talking collectively about Black scouts, African-American scouts, and coaches. We had always sort of had our meetings, so to speak, talking about the opportunities, the lack of opportunities, and scouting and coaching and so forth for African-Americans. And in 2001, 2002, under the direction and leadership of Cyrus Mary, legal counsel there at and Todd Labor, lawyer, and Johnny Cochran had got together and had this study done there at the University of Pennsylvania by a lady named Janet Warren. And in that study, it brought out the fact that minority coaches simply did not get the opportunities to be, quote, head coaches. They simply did not get that opportunity. And I'm sure you're familiar with the study, the fact that you have it during the show, what that study was about and so forth. And when I saw that study and the press conference that Johnny Cochran and Cyrus Mary had there about it, I didn't know Cyrus, but I'd been at several workshops with Johnny Cochran there in New Orleans, the Essence program that always had show every year. Johnny always headed up a group called workshop called Brother to Brother. And he always talked about how we have to work together, move together, and so forth. And so I knew Johnny from that side of it, but I didn't know Cyrus. But I called Cyrus's office, and I said to a young lady named Jackie Lee, who was at that time, she's now deceased, was Cyrus' administrative person. And I said to her, if Johnny and Cyrus are serious, tell them to call me and let's see what we can do. And of course, they did call. And I said, if you guys are really serious, then let's go to Indianapolis and talk to the scouts and coaches there about what's going on in the National Football League. And they were willing to do that, and that's what we did. And Kellen Winslow, who is the Hall of Fame tight end and so forth, was a person that we had always been a part of and talked with and everything. Kellen went with us, and we all met there in Indianapolis. Room was packed. Guys sitting on the floor. We had called an impromptu type meeting, word of mouth meeting. And guys were just all over the hall there at the Hyatt Regency there in Indianapolis. And we talked about a strategy of what we were going to have to do, need to do, and so forth. And Terry Rubisky, who is assistant head coach at the Falcons now, and Jimmy Ray, and those guys who are leaders and top coaches and offensive coaches that have been interim type of head coaches but never had the jobs as head coaches. And we talked at length about what we need to do, how we need to do it, and so forth. And right there, the vote came back that let's organize and be a part of presenting a new platform to the league. Commissioner Taglebaum was the commissioner at that time. And Johnny Cochran made a statement publicly that if the league was not willing to NFL was not willing to negotiate this type of situation, then it must be litigated. And with that, we got to give Commissioner Taglebaum credit, because he could have taken the position that we're going to fight it in the courts. But instead, he came back with the NFL Diversity Committee, headed by Mr. Dan Rooney of the Pittsburgh Steelers. And I said to Johnny and to Cyrus at the time, we have just won. When the commissioner made that particular move, I felt that this was a victory that we could seize upon and move forward on, and that's what we did. And consequently, in meeting there in the league office, as a matter of fact, Commissioner Roger Goodell headed up that meeting. He wasn't the commissioner at this time. Taglebaum is the commissioner. But Roger is the right-hand man. And he headed up the committee. We met, we talked, came with the thoughts and ideas of having a rule, a commitment from the owners, that if there were openings, that minorities had to be interviewed for these openings as head coach before you could do that. And the Rooney Rule actually came from us. The name of the Rooney Rule, the thought of it and so forth came directly out of Cyrus's mind of the diverse slate of candidates, that the whole thing came that way. The name Rooney Rule came because of the outstanding job that Ambassador Dan Rooney now, but at the time he was just an owner of the Steelers, because he pushed for those owners to accept this initiative that we were putting in front of them. And that's why it's called the Rooney Rule. That's where the name comes from. But the initiative itself came directly from Cyrus Mary, in terms that if there were openings at the head coach's position, that, quote, minorities had to be interviewed before you could make the hire. That's what the Rooney Rule is about. That's how it came about. Okay? I've done a lot of talking. Is there any questions at this point?
Mr. Wooten, again, thank you for joining us. And I want to say I'm a huge proponent of the Rooney Rule. I participate in a lot of sports conversations on a lot of blogs. I've certainly defended the rule over the years. And I love the way that it's been expanded to apply to GMs now. But my question to you is, what do you feel about the ways that teams seem to get around the Rooney Rule, either with the so-called, and I hate to use this word, but the token interviews of a minority head coach who they have no intention to hire, or even to a different extreme like this year, where teams could interview a very highly qualified candidate like a Lovie Smith and still get around the rule. So do you feel that it's still working in the way that it's intended, with teams seemingly being able to bypass it, and one team in Detroit who obviously did bypass it one year?
Well, you're going all the way back. And when you do that, you're going all the way back. And, you know, we all understand how people have played games with it. And as a matter of fact, the hiring for the 2013 season, I felt, was, I don't call it a sham interview, I call it a compliance interview. And what we said following, when there were eight head coach openings and, quote, no minority hired, six general manager openings and no minorities hired, we call that a compliance type of interview. And we said this to Commissioner Goodell and Ambassador Rooney and Jeff Pasch and the other top officials at the NFL. We met just before Super Bowl 47 there on Thursday in New Orleans, and we went over the very fact of what had just taken place. We went over the very fact of what we saw. You're not going to hear us hollering and screaming in newspapers and demonstrating and all that. That's not our style. Our style is to go behind the scene and show them exactly what is taking place and why we need to change it. We saw that change take place with the general manager's situation a year after the Rooney Rule that went into effect with, quote, head coaches. So now the director of football operations and the general managers also have to come under the same rule. And again, Ambassador Rooney has been in the forefront of dealing with the owners on these issues, you know. And again, we sort of lost that the 2 years that he left the Steelers to go and work for the president as the ambassador to Ireland. And I felt that this is where, you know, we lost his impetus of dealing with those owners. So we came back this past year with the fact that we said to them, when I said them, I'm talking about the commissioner and Ambassador Rooney and Jeff Pasch and Ray Anderson at the time, who is now no longer there as executive vice president of football operations. He is now out at Arizona State as the athletic director. But the point we made to them is this. We want a commitment that no owner, no general manager will interview anybody who he really doesn't feel that this is a person that he will hire. You know, you can't legislate people's heart and soul. You have to rely on that they want to do what is right. And everybody knows what is right. Doing what is right may be a hard road to follow, but it's not a road that you don't know, you see. So consequently, we said that very strongly. And this year, during the hiring cycle, men like Lovie Smith, who had been fired with a 10-6 record there at Chicago after having the kind of record of winning the division, Super Bowl participant, and with a 10-6 record, he's fired. And not only is he fired, but he doesn't get another job. And yet, Andy Reid is fired with a 4-12 record, and within 8 days, he has a new job. This is the kind of calamity and the just disappointment that you have in this kind of business, that this kind of thing would happen, that a coach like Jim Caldwell, who had taken over for Baltimore during the season and just really helped Flacco to go to an amazing performance all the way through to the Super Bowl and won the Super Bowl. And the thing that was amazing is no interceptions. Now, that may not mean a whole lot to you guys, but in the game that we play, for you to go through an entire playoff season and not have any interceptions, no turnovers, you're doing outstanding. So this was what Jim Caldwell had done, yet following the 2012 season, Jim Caldwell got not one single interview for head coach. These are the kind of things that we deal with behind the doors and talking to the people who we know shape this league and the way it goes and how it goes. So consequently, this is what we've said to them over and over and over. All we ask is that the interview be a professional interview, that no single person is bought in for an interview, that you know you have no intentions of hiring. It's just that simple. And I think you saw this year, not only did the interviews go great, we had some guys, Todd Bowles, said that the interview with Cleveland was taking too long, or not the interview, but the interview process of selection, and withdrew his name. You saw the same thing at the Miami situation with Ray Farmer and Lake Dawson, where they turned down the position. And there's nothing wrong with that. Except my holler was, finish the process. I'm not saying that you don't want to take the job, you don't have to take it, but let's finish the process, you know. And that's what we expect of our guys, that they finish the process. I hope that answers your question.
Mr. Wooten, what type of work does the Fritz Power Alliance do with coaches as they're getting ready for interviews? I know we talk a lot about guys being the right fit and making sure that everyone gets that chance. So what type of work does the Power Alliance do to get guys ready for that big interview?
One of the things that we try to do is to watch the games and so forth and try to figure out what guys, based on the coaching level and their performance of their players or in their team and how they're moving and how we see. One of the things that we try to get from our training and teaching in this business is we were told many years when we joined the Cowboys in 75 that even though you're in scouting and you're looking for players, when you go to schools, take it upon yourself to watch what the coaches are teaching and how well they teach it and how well they motivate and develop their own players. We never left that criteria because we were trained by what we thought were the very best, and that was the Dallas Cowboys in 75 under the leadership of Tex Ram, Gil Brandt, and Coach Tom Landry. So we have taken those ideas that we were taught in our basic training of going how to evaluate coaches as well as players, and then trying to use those developmental skills and evaluation skills, we try to come every year with what we call a ready list. And on that ready list, we have coaches and general managers and directors of player personnel and all throughout the operations of NFL clubs. And we have a list. And on that list, we are continually talking with those coaches, and we put together a document called, so you want to be a head coach in the NFL. And in that, we've taken the information and put it into a, here's the way you plan it, here's the way you got to have your work structured and so forth for you. Then we do the same thing with a document called, so you want to be an NFL executive. And we give that to them. And we're talking with them all year long about it. Preparation, how you go about selecting your staff, the kind of people you want on your staff, the knowing the teams that you're going to be interviewed by. Here's what you need to know about those teams. Here's the way you got to look at them. Here's what you have to have when you are preparing for the interview. So we don't send them in there raw and naked. We send them in there, and what we also do is, following the interview, we immediately talk to the interviewee about what happened, how did it go, who was in the room, all of the things that we need to hear about. And then we go to the team and we ask the team to critique the interview. Tell us where he was strong, where he was weak, what things he needed to tighten up on, and so forth. And that kind of relationship, again, of people working open and honest, and that's a key word in our business, open and honest, of what you're trying to get done. The NFL Diversity and Inclusion Committee, headed by Ambassador Rooney and Katie Blackburn and the Workplace Committee, they are working, Robert Gulliver, who's taken over there, who Executive Vice President of Human Resources for the NFL. All of these people, all of us are working together in the teams of trying to make the NFL a better place to work and play. And as I said, the success that we've had is the success of all of us pushing, pulling, doing the things that we feel can make this situation better. So I hope I answered your question about how we help to prepare them.
Mr. Wooten, this is Trey Murphy, and first of all, I just wanted to say thank you so much for being on our show, but more importantly, thank you for everything that you've done in your tireless efforts to help make the sports community a more level playing field. I was taking a look at a photograph of you taken back when many players came together to defend Muhammad Ali, and there's some pretty interesting names that's on that list. We had Bill Russell on there, we had Jim Brown, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and it had me thinking about back then. It seemed like there was a lot more unity within the African American community in general. And now in today's day and age, social media, Twitter, Facebook, MySpace, and any of those social media type networks has seemed to push the athlete to become more of an individual. So I'm curious to know, do today's athletes seem less political because they're not unified as, say, you guys were back in the days? And if that is the case, what can we do from our standpoint as being entrepreneurs of social media to help facilitate the problem and maybe encourage players to become more united and stand on one front like you and everybody else did?
Well, you know, it is gratifying that you recognize what that was about, you know, because it's one of the real great feeling of moments in my life as I look back at it. And I know that I've been blessed to have seen this country. And, you know, I went to segregated schools up in grade, okay? And then, of course, we also moved very strongly in terms of what we felt was the right way and so forth. And the thing that picture that you mentioned here in 1967, we and Jim was the lead. Jim Brown was the leader of this. I don't know if you guys are familiar with an organization called the Black Economic Union that was also moving in terms of economic development in the various communities around the country, in Washington, D.C., Kansas City, New York, Cleveland was the headquarters, and so forth. But what you're looking at is this. We had all become friends. Jim and all of us had become friends to Ali back when he was going to be fighting Sonny Liston in Florida. We were in Florida to play a game called the Run-Up Bowl, okay? So all of us back in those days sort of hung out together. There was a place there in Florida called Miami called the King of Hearts Hotel, Motel, Bar, and so forth. And this is where everybody, when you went to Miami, you sort of gathered. And that's where that relationship was formed. And Ali was there to fight Sonny Liston, and we were there to play Detroit Lions. And so Night Train Lane, just all of us would be hanging out at the King of Hearts. So when Ali didn't step forward there in Houston, that his position was that he was a conscientious objector and a minister of the Muslim faith, and therefore he shouldn't have to go to the service, military. And they really were intending to put Ali in jail. They wouldn't strip away his title and so forth. And Jim calls me and he says, get the guys together and let's meet in Cleveland to show support for the champ. And I said, we got it. So those gentlemen that you saw on that picture, you saw Curtis McClendon from the Kansas City Chiefs, Willie Davis from the Green Bay Packers, Bobby Mitchell from the Washington Redskins, Jim, of course, myself from the Cleveland Browns. I don't know how close you're looking at it, but on there also was our legal counsel, who was Mayor Carl Stokes, the first black mayor of a major city, Cleveland. Walter Beach, Sidney Williams, who later became the ambassador to the Bahamas under Clinton and married to Maxine Waters. The thing that was so gratifying to me is as I called them and told them when they needed to be in Cleveland and where we were going to assemble, not one single one said to me, who's going to pay for this? What's going to be this? What? They simply said, I'll be there. You know, and we met with the champ and listened to him explain to us his feelings. And to a man, after he had finished, said, we stand with you. And that's what you see there on that picture. Why is that true then and may not be true now? We're living in an age of individuality, where everybody wants his own little fiefdom and his own little system and so forth. Until I think that so many of our our athletes don't quite understand what it means to pull together. Right here in Dallas, very few, if any, of the African-American athletes ever go south of the Trinity. That's the dividing line sort of between north and south as relates to where the populations of the communities are. The majority of African-American people live south of the Trinity. So the baseball, the basketball, you know, even though those guys don't live in the community the way we did back in our day, we lived in the community of the black community. So consequently, going to the black churches, our kids going to the black schools, pulled us into a different era of work and pulling back. So we got to continually say to our youngsters, it doesn't matter if you work over here. You got to take it upon yourself to go into the black community and be a part of that community. Set up your camps so that these kids get a chance to feel you, touch you, hear you. But they only just don't see you on television. That is a commitment. That is a commitment that has to come from the very deep into your heart and soul of what you're about. You know, of what you're about. That is the commitment that you have to make. And that's where perhaps a lot of our young people today, our African-American athletes and so forth, they're not told that. They're not shown that. And consequently, they may not know what to do. So it's up to us to continue to lead them and show them, you know, what has to be done. What is the obligation? You have an obligation. To hear Barkley say that he doesn't think he's a role model, whether he thinks he is or not, he is a role model. Somebody's looking at him, and that's where that obligation has to come. That I'm going to do and show and give back because somebody gave it to me. You know, it doesn't matter where it came from or how it got there. Somebody somewhere gave you this opportunity. Somebody held your hand and showed you how to shoot a basketball, how to jump, what to do, and so forth. Somebody did that. Whoever it was. Pay it forward, pay it back. I don't care which way you pay it, but give it back to somebody else.
We would like to thank Chairman John Wooten of the Fritz Pollard Alliance for spending some time with us here on the Section 357 show. And you always know how we do on this show, guys. Last call. And let's do last call about coaches. So who is your favorite personal coach in your life? Last call. D, what do you have?
My favorite coach, and I've been struggling to remember his name. I really wish I could remember his name. But he was a soccer coach. This was an Italian guy that was my elementary school soccer coach. And he was epic. I mean, this is back in the early 80s. This is a guy that smoked a pack a day, but this is also a guy that loved soccer. Like his kid, who was part of my team, they had an indoor, quote-unquote, soccer arena in their basement that was marked out with tape, with you know, the half-court line and the goal lines and the penalty box and everything. It was just great. This was the type of guy that would, like I said, smoke a pack a day, but could still, I really feel, play a 90-minute game at a high quality. You know, he had those thighs of a soccer player and taught us about playing a game. I think, in the back of my head, this is part of the reason why I still find myself drawn back to soccer, even though I'm an American sports fan.
Last call, Ron. Your favorite personal coach, man. Go for it.
My sixth grade basketball coach, Dwayne Jackson, was the first guy I thought to really push confidence. I think a lot of times for kids, when they're first playing sports or as they move along, confidence is such a big thing for kids. And he was one of the first ones to really instill confidence and that support. So he's kind of my favorite guy. I've had many coaches since then who have been good to me and helping me with my game, but that first one, the first one to really believe in you, always sticks out. So Mr. Dwayne Jackson, definitely my favorite. Hall, who was your guy? Who was your first sports coach? Who was your favorite?
I want to give a shout out to actually two coaches, Coach Carson and Coach Hurd. These were two of my baseball coaches growing up here in Atlanta. And I played under Coach Hurd at Welcome All Park, and I played under Coach Carson at Westlake High School. And both of these coaches were your typical hard-nosed baseball coaches who were really hands-on and really instilled a sense of toughness into us as kids. So I will never forget some of those life lessons as it relates to teamwork and trusting the guy next to you to perform at their best and to give your best to the team. So Coach Carson and Coach Hurd, two of my favorite coaches of all time in my childhood. With that being said, good luck to you and your favorite teams and coaches out there, wherever you might be. This is the Section 357 show, where we always have the best seats in the house. Until next time, take care.